This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music Magazine for February of 2022, Julian Haylock brings us closer to the art of violinist Yascha Heifetz. Yascha Heifetz was a phenomenon. His playing sounded like no one else's, and his immaculately honed technique and unflappable stage presence created an aura of invincibility. A perfectionist in all things musical, he insisted that the discipline of practice every day is essential. When I skip a day, I notice a difference in my playing. After 2 days, the critics notice, and after 3 days, so does the audience. As Heifetz saw it, there is no top. There are always further heights to reach. His preference for fast, flowing tempos was facilitated by a dazzling technique and a clear, focused sound, colored by a fast, narrow vibrato and subtly warmed by his preference for a plain gut, as opposed to steel-wound metal, D and A strings. Adding to the sensation of unflappable calm were his impassive facial features and a no-nonsense, free-flowing, bowing action. Although in concert, Heifetz produced a luminous sound, on disc, especially in later years, he preferred a relatively close, almost analytical image, free of ambient cushioning. It was the tantalizing gulf between Heifetz's cool demeanor and the molten intensity of his playing that so fascinated his audiences. The legendary Fritz Kreisler, Heifetz's own favorite violinist, was so affected by his incandescent virtuosity that he despaired, "We might as well take our fiddles and break them across our knees." For Itzhak Perlman, Heifetz was quite simply the violinist of the century. There's basically Heifetz, then all the rest. As if to add to the mystique surrounding his playing, Heifetz dryly summed up his early career in one short sentence. Born in Russia, first lessons at 3, debut in Russia at 7, debut in America at 1917, that's all there is to say, really. Born in Lithuania, then part of the Russian Empire, in 1901, Heifetz's first teacher was his father, a capable player who quickly realized he was dealing with a talent way beyond his own. Remarkably, in only 4 years, Yascha progressed from an infant beginner to playing the Mendelssohn E minor concerto on a half-sized violin to an astonished audience of over 1,000. 3 years later, aged just 10, Heifetz began lessons with the renowned pedagogue Leopold Auer, who appears to have taught his students more by a process of friendly coercion than strict task setting. "Don't ask me how he did it," Heifetz reflected, "for I would not know how to tell you." Auer was far too astute a teacher to let his admiration show unduly, but in a private letter admitted, "In all my 50 years of violin teaching, I have never known such precocity." While still Auer's student, Heifetz established his early reputation, including making his Berlin Concerto debut at short notice, aged only 11. Playing the Tchaikovsky under conductor Arthur Nikisch. According to one onlooker, the tumultuous applause Heifetz received that night was encouraged from the platform by the normally restrained Nigish and the players of the Berlin Philharmonic. The Tchaikovsky became one of Heifetz's signature pieces, a work he felt was already so overloaded with sentiment that all you have to do is to play the notes. It will come out anyway. By the time Heifetz and his family left Russia prior to the October Revolution in 1917, bound for the U.S., his reputation had preceded him. Yet nothing could have prepared the audience for the incendiary playing at his Carnegie Hall debut recital with pianist André Benoist on 27 October 1917. Stories surrounding this career-defining concert are now legion, yet even the coolest examination of the evidence leaves little doubt that Heifetz's playing of, amongst other things, Paganini's Caprice No. 24 and Wieniawski's Second Concerto created a sensation. The newspapers were buzzing with news of the Wunderkind. Heifetz was still only 16 at the time, including a review in the New York World that reported, "Nothing that he undertook was without a finish so complete, so carefully considered and worked out, that its betterment did not seem possible." Among the musical glitterati that night was violin virtuoso Misha Elman, a former Auer pupil of an older generation. According to one story which hit the popular press, turning towards his pianist friend Leopold Godowski, Elman muttered, "It's getting awfully hot in here," to which Godowski replied with a knowing twinkle in his eye, "Not for pianists." Just 2 weeks later, Heifetz cut his first discs for the Victor Talking Machine Company, later RCA Victor, effectively marking the start, a few early Russian and domestic German takes aside, of a recording career spanning some 55 years. Today, when we can stream almost anything, it is easy to forget just how revolutionary the recording process was at that time. Music lovers could now, in the comfort of their own homes, listen repeatedly to musicians they had never seen perform live. Within a very short space of time, musicians' reputations became founded upon their recorded rather than concert legacy. When Heifetz made his London Queen's Hall debut in 1920, RCA could already boast sales of around 70,000 units in Britain alone. Heifetz's reputation hadn't just preceded him by word of mouth. Many fans had a fair idea of what they were in for before Heifetz had even played a note on English soil. The newish recording technology had its downsides, however. In order to squeeze their interpretations onto existing side lengths, around 3 to 5 minutes, depending on disc size, some artists had little choice but to gently speed up their interpretations. Others found the pressure of producing a clean take incredibly stressful, resulting in countless retakes, while others found the need to keep reasonably still and limit extraneous noises to a minimum, inhibiting. Such strictures played to Heifetz's strengths. His rapier-like precision, keen musical focus, and absolute physical discipline were tailor-made for the recording process. Another important factor that made Heifetz's recording so unusually compelling was his lack of reliance on stagecraft when playing live to enhance the musical impact of his performances. For Heifetz, everything he wished to express was concentrated in the microcosmic perfection of his playing. Nothing was left to chance and was worked out down to the last detail beforehand. This gave him the necessary freedom, like fellow violinist Nathan Milstein, to improvise fingerings as the mood took him. In that respect, every performance and every recording became part of a continual learning curve. For some listeners, the results could sometimes feel almost glacial in their cool perfection. Yet the essential difference between Heifetz and his peers was really a matter of degree. He spoke the same musical language, but did so with such fine-tuned reflexes that if you musically blinked, even for a second, you would almost certainly miss something. There were also those who felt Heifetz tended to overshadow his partners when playing chamber music, even with Million Dollar Trio co-members, pianist Arthur Rubinstein and cellist Gregor Piatigorsky. But as the young André Previn, among others, pointed out, this wasn't so much a case of his playing too forcefully, but rather because he was musically so much more interesting than everyone else. Heifetz's recordings played an important role in establishing the Sibelius, Elgar, and Glazunov concertos, Bruch's Scottish Fantasy, and J.S. Bach's solo sonatas and partitas, among others, as repertoire standards. And some of his most treasurable playing on disc can be found in the Korngold, Rosa, Walton, and Castelnuovo Tedesco No. 2, I Profeti, concertos, all written in a post-romantic idiom and premiered by Heifetz. Yet he was not all that taken with modern music in general. "I play works by contemporary composers for two reasons," he once claimed. "First, to discourage the composer from writing anymore, and secondly, to remind myself how good Beethoven is." Between his 1917 U.S. debut and his final public appearance in 1974 at the University of Southern California alongside Piatigorsky, Heifetz sustained the same impregnable musical poise and implacable stage presence. As he once put it, "If I don't smile, it's only because I'm so absorbed in my playing that I forget everything else." He owned several important violins during his career, but the one he valued above all others was a 1742 Guarneri del Gesù, once owned by Ferdinand David, dedicatee of the Mendelssohn E minor violin concerto. His preferred bow was a Nikolai Kittel, given to him by Auer. Heifetz was a generous donator, not only of instruments and bows to his students, but by giving numerous benefit concerts for various good causes. In 1919, he appeared at the Metropolitan Opera House with fellow émigré Sergei Rachmaninoff, raising a small fortune to help offset the government deficit following the First World War. During the Second World War, he gave innumerable concerts, often at great risk to his personal safety, playing from the back of a touring flatbed truck in and near war zones. Countless are the stories of his deep concern for injured soldiers in whose company he would allow the mask to drop, tell jokes, and share reminiscences. Ironically, the greatest threats to Heifetz's life came after the war, when in 1953 he was attacked in Jerusalem by a man wielding a crowbar for playing Richard Strauss's violin sonata, Heifetz having done so despite requests by Israeli officials not to do so. And in 1959, when he slipped on a floor in a Beverly Hills delicatessen, fractured his hip and almost died from the resulting infection. A right shoulder injury finally persuaded Heifetz to retire from public performance, although he went on playing in private with pupils and colleagues. In the meantime, he accepted two university teaching posts and became one of the most notoriously exacting mentors in history. For Heifetz, violin playing was a perishable art that must be passed on as a personal skill, otherwise it is lost. He stressed especially the importance of scales for technical and intonational accuracy, not just in single notes, but in consecutive thirds and tenths. He taught over 150 pupils during his 10-year stint at the University of Southern California, and afterwards continued to teach privately. Those who passed Heifetz's uncompromising regime to become soloists in their own right included Eric Friedman, Eugene Fodor, and most notably Pierre A. Moyal, to whom Heifetz gifted a beautiful Vuillaume violin. Heifetz died on the 10th of December, 1987, following a brain hemorrhage a few weeks short of his 87th birthday. Widely mourned behind his austere stage presence was a man who cared passionately about a range of causes. He was a devoted union supporter and became so concerned about the air quality in L.A. that he had his car converted to electric power long before it became fashionable. He was also a gifted mimic, especially of other violinists. An accomplished pianist with a penchant for breaking into Tin Pan Alley classics and jazz, a fine arranger of around 150 pieces, and composed the popular song "When You Make Love to Me, Don't Make Believe," under the pseudonym Jim Hoyt. A light-hearted alter ego, he adopted away from the glare of public celebrity. Above all, Heifetz's tremendous sense of humor made him the heart and soul of any gathering. His self-deprecating wit extended to his directing a performance of Tales from the Vienna Woods, dressed as Johann Strauss II, complete with tuxedo and mustachios, at a benefit concert, which helped save the Metropolitan Opera House from imminent closure. But perhaps the most poignant of all Heifetz stories concerns his being stopped in New York's Manhattan District and asked by a music fan how to get to Carnegie Hall. Without missing a beat, the great man replied, "Practice, practice, practice." In the BBC Music Magazine for October of 2023, we get to interview up-and-coming pianist Juliette Journeau. Where were you born? Paris, France. What would be your career highlights so far? A Mahler Lieder recital I gave with the baritone Liviu Hollander at the Philharmonie de Paris. The last piece was Revenge, the story of a drummer boy whose regiment falls in a trap during the night. The boy's fiancée discovers him dead at dawn. The intensity of the piece made this concert very special for me. Who are your musical heroes? Pianist Radu Liupu. His Schubert Impromptus album tore me apart as a child, and still does now. His piano sound is from another planet. It's powerful, intense, and dense, but always with an infinite poetry, even vulnerability. What would be your dream concert? Playing Fauré's piano trio in Monet's garden in Giverny. In the October 12th, 2023 edition of the Guardian newspaper, Kate Connolly interviews Joanna Malwitz, the new chief conductor at the Berlin Konzerthaus. For months, Joanna Malwitz's image has been plastered on billboards throughout Berlin, heralding her arrival as the new chief conductor at the Konzerthaus. She is, they proclaim, the next big thing. A virtual unknown figure in the Berlin capital until recently, the musician says she can no longer go to the supermarket or local bakery without being recognized. The build-up was massive, says Malwitz, who was inaugurated last month. I had to push it all away from me, saving myself, as it were, by concentrating on getting to know the musicians, or on how I wanted to conduct bar 17 of a particular symphony. It is with a certain unease that Malwitz seeks to explain the enthusiasm with which her appointment has been received. There is her youth. Having started her career at aged 19, she is now aged 37, by far the youngest music director to lead a house in Berlin's teeming classical music world. which boasts 7 large orchestras and 3 opera houses. There is also the fact that she is female. In the more than 300 years in which the city has proved its global status as a thriving and influential music center, her appointment marks the first time the top job in a leading Berlin orchestra has been given to a woman. "This is of absolutely no relevance to my work," she says, approaching the issue with caution. "When you're standing in front of an orchestra, you're only concerned with one question. Does it work or not? It's what a conductor's life depends on." On the other hand, Malowitz is quick to say she's not realitätsfremd, out of touch with reality. "I realize there is still the need to talk about these matters. The perfect situation would be if we arrive at a place when it is no longer interesting to even ask me the question." The comparisons between Malowitz and Lydia Tarr, the chief conductor of a large Berlin orchestra played by Cate Blanchett in Todd Field's psychodrama, have been rife. There have even been references to the supposed targeting of Malowitz by the Konzerthaus's publicity team. She elegantly dismisses them. "I know it's ridiculous. I really want to see the film, and I adore Cate Blanchett. But it's been such a whirlwind, I've had no time. But the comparisons between me and her, well, it's just the hair, right? To be honest, people have been saying to me for the past 20 years that I and Blanchett look a little bit alike. And, you know, I'm sure she has no clue about me." Friends, perhaps the same ones who says originally tried to steer her away from the Shark Tank world of conducting, have told her enough about the film for her to ask whether it's actually a good thing to be compared with a fictional Tarr, a haughty, paranoid autocrat. In contrast, the musicians who work under Malowitz talk of her lack of hubris. "Absolutely modest, completely subservient to the music," is how one harpist from Nuremberg's State Theater describes her. When Malowitz left as general music director after 5 years at the Bavarian city, 65,000 people attended an emotional open-air farewell concert in July. Not generally known to eulogize, Berlin's music critics have been unusually effervescent. The reviewer of her debut Konzerthaus performance in the Berlin tabloid BZ described her conducting style as high voltage, her interpretation of Prokofiev as refreshing, raw, risk-taking, and said she had unleashed the galloping youthful furor of Kurt Weill's Berlin Symphony, her dance-like movements suggesting she was strung with elastic. The Süddeutsche praised her ability to plumb the emotional depths of the music. Der Spiegel has described Malowitz, just 3 years old when the Berlin Wall fell, as the antithesis of the antiquated image of the maestro, embodied in such towering figureheads as 80-year-old Daniel Berenbaum, whose resignation for health reasons as general music director of the Staatsoper, after 30 years, caused shockwaves across the classical music community. And his recently announced successor and former rival, 64-year-old conservative heavyweight Christian Tilemann. Diplomatically adept, she responds, "You know, there are also so many other people out there, men and women, who are a counterpoint to the antique maestro." She has congratulated Tilemann, she says, recalling the joy she felt as a student 2 decades ago in Berlin of slipping into his rehearsals and those of the city's other great conductors, like Sir Simon Rattle, and realizing their own counterparts were in the stalls watching them. I thought, this is amazing. This sort of support, comradeship, and exchange, which is what makes this city so rich. It's wrong to talk of rivalries. You can learn something from everyone, and everyone is very different. It's a privilege for me to be a small part of that now. At the same time, she says, it's no longer enough to say I'll don my dress coat, take to the stage, bow, direct my symphony, and expect people to be drawn to the concert hall. It would be presumptuous to think that's the case. She wants to reach people who don't know how passionate they might yet be about classical music because they haven't necessarily experienced it yet. Her trademark so-called Expeditionskonzert format, in which, together with the musicians, she takes the audience on a journey through a piece of music ahead of a concert, are sell-out events and her own way of communicating her passion for the music. She recalls being 16 and seeing a performance of Igor Stravinsky's Le Sacre du Printemps, or The Rite of Spring. She got hold of the score and brought it into school. I was floored by it on a complete high, and once I told my friends, they were suddenly all into Sacre. On a recent Sunday afternoon, she sat on the edge of a piano stool on the stage, describing to the captive audience of a packed concert house the huge scandal the charmingly dissonant work had provoked at its 1913 world premiere in Paris. Stravinsky, she explained, had finished composing it under the influence of unbearable toothache. It hasn't lost any of its power, she tells them. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.